The speakers today will be introduced by Monica Ramirez. Ms. Ramirez is the Research Translation Coordinator for the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program. She has experience moving information and technology from researchers into the hands of decision makers at all levels. Some of her activities include building linkages and partnerships with U.S. and Mexican government agencies, creating innovative bilingual communication tools, and conducting informal learning experiences for people of all ages. She has an MPA in Environmental Science and Policy from Columbia University. We'll now turn the time over to Monica.
Thanks, Justin. So the overall goal of the Research Translation Corps is to actively communicate the research products generated by our Superfund research program, as well as others, to pertinent audiences and stakeholders in the most effective and appropriate manner. In addition, to improve these efforts, there's going to be a short survey at the end of the seminar entitled Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institution and Remediation Stakeholders. It would be greatly appreciated if you could complete the survey, and the results would definitely be put to good use. So I just wanted to plug that in right in the beginning. So the EPA Superfund Research Program Seminar Series is the result of an ongoing collaborative effort between EPA Region 9 Superfund and Technical Liaison Mike Gill and myself. After discussing and delineating the scientific needs of the regional project managers and research strengths of the Superfund program, Gill and I decided to design an information and transfer series that has two parts. The first is called Live at Region 9, where a Superfund research program investigator presents at Region 9 headquarters. And then the second part is the Internet seminar, which we are about to hear, that incorporates input from that live presentation. Due to its success, because it began with just being the University of Arizona Superfund program, Gill and I believed that opened up the seminar series to all of the Superfund research programs in Region 9. So we are delighted that Mr. Saravia and Dr. Pizzoli from UCSD kicked off the series for the West Coast Superfund research program, and they will present collaborative research on environmental toxicants in rapidly developing settlements of the U.S.-Mexico border. I will also introduce the speakers quickly. Keith Pizzoli is the Director of Field Research and a lecturer in the Urban Studies and Planning Program at the University of California, San Diego. He also leads the Research Translation and Community Outreach Corps of UCSD's Superfund Research Program. Pizzoli's teaching and research concentrate on regional ecology and globalism, new biology and environmental health, sustainability science, and information technology. Pizzoli leads the Regional Workbench Consortium and the Global Action Research Center. Currently, he is conducting action research at the Water Climate Poverty Nexus in low-income human settlements of the U.S.-Mexico border region. In addition, Iram Saravia is the environmental scientist for UCSD's Superfund research program. Saravia's research applications for emerging technologies in the detection of environmental toxicants, remediation, and risk assessment. For over a decade, his research has focused on water, soil, and sediment contamination issues that affect ecosystems and public health in the U.S.-Mexico border. Mr. Saravia has also led large-scale citizen science efforts to address sustainability issues impacting vulnerable communities on both sides of the border. Iram Saravia completed his undergraduate and graduate studies at the University of San Diego. So I will now pass it over to our speakers at UCSD.
Okay. Thanks so much, Monica. And I'd like to thank you and Mike Gill and Justin and everybody at the NIEHS for giving us this opportunity to share. Is everybody hearing me okay?
Yes, we are. Go right ahead. Thank you.
Very good. So we're on slide one, and this shows me presenting along with Hiram Saravia. And you could probably guess from the intros that this is, for us, a marriage made in heaven, me and Hiram being able to do this together, because I bring a kind of urban planning, built environment focus to this, where he brings environmental sciences, and so we've been able to make some pretty interesting connections. So if we now go to slide two, shows the focus area that we'll be talking about today. This Los Laureles Canyon in green spans the U.S.-Mexican border, and we're talking today about collaborative research on environmental toxicants in this area, and we have some good relationships with Mexican scientists across the border. If we go to slide three, this is I promise this is the only slide that I'm actually going to read from. Most of our slides are image-based, but these are the 2 points that we wanted to get across in this presentation, describing what our project's aims are. And we're developing new watershed-based strategies, models, that can help the NIEHF address global environmental health. So this particular project was partly funded as a supplemental to our main grant to look at the cross-border regions and concerns about toxicants from a global environmental health perspective. And secondly, share the science and technology contributions of UCSD's Superfund research program with urban regional planning scholars, educators, and professionals who are struggling to better understand how problems of the built environment, land use, and pollution impact environmental public health. We feel like this is an important niche to be looking at, that is to say the relationship of the built environment in cities to environmental and public health. So if we go to the slide number 4, I just quickly want to draw attention to kind of context that's pushing us in the way that we've pulled our project together in interdisciplinary and bringing a global focus into view, is that we see there's 4 trends going on that are really significant and I must say, you know, impacting the likelihood that we'll be successful in bringing science to bear in solving some of the problems that we face. The first thing is the globalization of human-environment interactions, risks, and disasters. I'm not going to say much about each of these things. I'd be happy to come back to this later or communicate with anybody offline about these things. But this globalization dimension is really important when you start to think about global environmental health and the globalization of disease vectors. And that's part of what we're dealing with in our project. The second thing is new modes of knowledge, production, communication, and networking. There's a lot going on with information integration, information visualization, and mapping, online interactive mapping. We exploit those kinds of things. The third thing, of course, is the institutional stresses and societal push for change in the face of increasingly complex problems. I mean, this is the whole sustainability theme here, that we have, in many ways, unsustainable types of development. This is dramatically illustrated in the border region, as you'll see some pictures of this. And so there are a real clamor for doing things differently. Finally, you know, we're doing this, most of us, doing this kind of research from universities, research universities, and there's a culture change in research universities, raising the value of transdisciplinary collaboration and civically engaged scholarship. So we've been able to take advantage of that as well. If we go to slide number 5, this is the border region that we work in, and is the San Diego Tijuana city region that we focus on is one of the biggest, it is the biggest city region along the U.S.-Mexico border. There's like 14 of these city regions. And Hiram is always quick to point out, the work that we look at in these low-income settlements is actually emblematic of a type of irregular, haphazard, lacking basic infrastructure type of human settlement development happening around the world. And certainly we see this dramatically along the U.S.-Mexico border. So our work is trying to build a model on how to deal effectively with some pretty wicked problems in low-income human settlements where there's concerns about risk and environmental and public health. So if we go to slide number six, here's just one illustration of the kind of information integration and visualization technology that we can use that's available to us. This particular slide shows, as best we could, a normalization of data concerning infant mortality, death rates among infants along the border. And you can see the concentration on the Mexican side compared to the U.S. side. So if we go to slide number 7, this is the Los Laureles Canyon. And my job in our division of labor with me and Hiram, I said I'd only take 5 minutes or so at the outset, six minutes, to set the stage. And Hiram is going to talk more specifically about exactly how we're deploying our universities, our Superfund research programs, technologies in the service of these vulnerable communities living in this red area. Our particular program, one of the technologies we're developing are molecular biomarkers, cellular bioassays, in which we're able to use these tools to do testing of soil and water sources there, and there's cause for concern for contamination. There are known hot spots in this particular area, and they don't have the resources to do the testing, and we've been trying to raise funds to figure out whether the dirt in front of the elementary school playground is safe, for instance. So there's a fairly sophisticated effort here to begin looking at the toxicants in that area, relating it to the built environment and what's causing these problems in the first place. So that's just kind of keep that in mind. This is a cross-border watershed. You see that blue arrow. What this indicates is that the toxicants in the water and the sediment flows go from higher up in Mexico down a downward slope from something like 800 foot elevation in the higher reaches of this red zone, this Los Laureles Canyon, to 5 feet above sea level in the estuary on the U.S. side. So there's a real, incentive here for us to work together with Mexico, because what happens upstream on the Mexican side dramatically affects us downstream on the U.S. side. So if we go to slide number 8, the globalization of science education, we bring students and participants in our program down to that community, and you see a few slides of what the community looks like and some of the erosion, to do things like build pervious pavers or an alternative type of street covering that will slow down the velocity of flow of water during storm events. And there's all sorts of advantages to these pervious pavers with respect to processing contaminants from automobiles and other sources. We won't go into all those details now, but this is an interesting slide. If we go to slide number 9, and this is my last slide here, I turn it over to Hiram. This, like I said, this is Mexico City, and I actually cut my teeth on scholarship in the 1980s working in Mexico City. Very similar problems. The erosion, the lack of infrastructure, exposure to hazardous wastes because of illegal dumping and so forth and so on. So we had thought of putting this slide in there just to remind us all that the story you're hearing today and the work that we're doing in Los Laureles Canyon is emblematic of the type of development that's happening worldwide. In fact, I read a statistic by, I believe it was UN Habitat, where one out of every three urban people in the world by 2030 is going to be living in pretty precarious urban conditions of the sort that we're going to be talking about and looking at today. So if we go to slide number 10, there is just one more slide of mine. This is just an attempt to give you kind of a sense of how all our pieces of the puzzle fit together. Since our work is Superfund research, you see at the bullseye here are these molecular mechanisms and models of exposure, the work that we're doing to develop new biology in service of vulnerable communities. In our case, it's, like I said, the cellular bioassays, the P450 reporter gene system. So that's at the bullseye here. But surrounding that, of course, is the environmental health sciences, ecotoxicology. Around that, you'll see urban and regional planning, watershed management. We have some interaction as well with climate change scientists. In fact, in case we forget to mention it, we're just about to release a UCSD TV documentary that speaks to the interaction between our program and climate change scientists and planners and epidemiologists. It's a pretty neat, it'll be a 30-minute long documentary that we'll also be showing at the upcoming AAAS conference here in San Diego. And the outermost ring here, multimedia arts, data, and visualization, because all of us involved in the research translation core activity know how important science communication is. So a lot of what we do tries to pay attention to how to do good science communication, exploiting as best we can advanced information and visualization technologies. Okay, so here's where we turn it over to Hiram.
Thank you very much, Keith, for the introduction. I'm going to be fairly brief just to give you a sense of what the setting is and what the types of questions and problems that we're dealing with in the Laureles Canyon are. I'd like to also thank Beth Anderson at NIEHS, Justin, Mike Gill at EPA, and Monica for putting this together. It's an honor for us to participate. I would like to point the listeners to go to slide number 12 now. And as Keith pointed out, we see the Laureles Canyon, this is the place, the location where we're working, as a microcosm of a much larger picture. We think that the Laureles Canyon is a microcosm for the Tijuana River watershed. And like Keith mentioned, most of this 1,700 square mile watershed is in Mexico, and Mexico sits at higher elevation. So naturally, with flows of water and other materials, waste comes from Mexico into the U.S., and this is partly why we're interested in this problem of cross-border flow of toxicants. Now, the Tijuana River watershed, we believe, is a microcosm for the U.S.-Mexico border. In other words, the problems of the canyon can be seen across the U.S.-Mexico border, and because, like Keith also mentioned, most of the new development in the world is happening in places that are irregular settlements oftentimes and that don't have a lot of the basic services. We think that a lot of the problems that we're researching dealing with introduction of toxicants into the environment and their effect on both ecological receptors and human health are similar to those that we see in other parts of the world. I'd like to go to slide number 13 now. And this slide, I just want to talk a little bit about the setting, the place where we live. We live in Southern California. The landscape here has been shaped by tectonic forces. We have ranges of mountains, coastal mountain ranges. And between the mountains and the ocean, we have very complex networks of canyons. And a lot of these canyons, the hills that make up the canyons, have resulted from tectonic uplift of beaches. And if you look at this image in the center, in the upper part of the slide, that's a satellite image that kind of shows, you could almost see the U.S.-Mexico border. It's not clearly delineated, but it's right at the center. On the southern or on the right-hand portion of that slide is Mexico, and on the left-hand portion of that slide is the U.S. Now, on the bottom left-hand side, you see a Google Earth image of San Diego. Now, San Diego is a modern city with a lot of the basic services for its population. It's not without issues of contamination, but if you contrast that to what's the predominant type of development on the Mexican side, it's really dramatic. On the lower right-hand side of this slide, you can see what the Laureles Canyon looks like. And you can see what I was talking about with most of these coastal hills being uplifted beaches. In other words, these are hills that have maybe 1 inch or 2 inches of topsoil that is being held together by native vegetation. What happens on the Mexican side is that when a developer comes in, they remove all of the native vegetation, which destabilizes the soil, causing tremendous erosion. And you can see the beach sand on the slide, on the lower right-hand corner of this slide, and this is what the community looks like. So the difference between the development on both sides of the border is very dramatic. Let me go to the next slide, slide number 14. This shows a satellite image on the right-hand side, on the upper right-hand side of the Laureles Canyon in the 1970s, and on the left-hand side, that's a present image. So the one from the right is 1973, the one from the left is 2009. If you look closely at the upper part of both of these slides, or both of these images, you see a road that goes from right to left. And that road approximately follows the border fence. And you can see how today, whereas before the canyon was mostly open space, how today houses are built right up to the border fence. Now this other image in the lower part here is meant to illustrate the interrelationships between San Diego and Tijuana. San Diego and Tijuana are inextricably connected. There is a constant flow of capital, of goods, of services, of people. There's a migration that happens every day of people going from Mexico to San Diego to work and then coming back to live in Tijuana. Likewise, there's also a flow of other things, like pathogens, disease, and toxicants, some of the things that we're looking at. Let me go to the next slide, slide number 15. Before I go, I'm sorry, if we could return briefly to slide number 14. What I wanted to say here is that the development of the border region as a whole, in general terms, has resulted from the introduction of the maquiladoras in the 1960s along the border before NAFTA, and then with NAFTA, the introduction of more maquiladoras are factories that produce something, like TVs. And Tijuana was the TV production capital of the world up until recently. Now, this placement of the factories along the border is very strategic because if the products are made in Tijuana and they need to be transported to the American market or to the market, it's very easy just to bring them across the border. Unfortunately, what that has done is that it has caused massive migration from not only from different parts of rural Mexico towards the border, but even Central America. We see people that are living in this canyon that are coming from Central America just to work in the factories. Now the next slide, please, 15. I just want to touch briefly upon some of the issues that we're looking at in terms of environmental contamination. Air quality is a big issue. Poor air quality is a big issue along the border. Sources of contaminants come from energy generation plants, the factories themselves, vehicles are a huge source of contamination. You have heavy vehicles, diesel trucks that are bringing products across the border also being an important source of contamination. The next slide, number 16, just to talk briefly about water pollution. We're a coastal region. Our beaches are oftentimes contaminated, again, from this flow across the border of sewage and other contaminants that drains on the U.S. side and towards the Pacific Ocean. This image on the right-hand side shows the Laureles Canyon, and this is a typical situation that you see in the Laureles Canyon, where you see sewage just flowing openly in the canyon. The image on the lower left-hand side of these trucks, these are trucks that bring water to places in Tijuana that don't have water services, like the Laureles Canyon. And oftentimes the source of the water that these trucks are bringing in is doubtful, and so the quality could be a problem. There are most of the groundwater, both on the U.S. side and on the Mexican side, has contamination problems. From industrial sources, sometimes even natural sources might be important, like arsenic can come from volcanic rock. And we do have certain extinct volcanoes in this area that could feasibly be contributing trace metals to our groundwater. The next slide, slide 17. 17 shows issues with solid waste. The city generates tremendous amounts of solid waste. Not all of the city is covered by the solid waste pickup service. There are many, many instances of mishandling of toxic waste. You see the organic waste intermixed with plastic, with electronics. We see in the canyon instances of dumping, where people bring in truckloads of industrial waste and dump it in the canyon. The canyon is sort of a no man's land. By Mexican law, these canyons should not be developed. But over time, and due to corruption and other issues, these canyons have been developed. Again, I was saying that we live in an area that is characterized by having mountains and then very complex systems of canyons. Well, in Tijuana, by the mid-1970s, most of the flatlands had already been developed. And the only open space was in the canyons. And a lot of people began to develop these canyons illegally. I want to point out to the image on the upper right-hand corner of this slide, those are drums, empty drums from an abandoned factory. This was an American-owned operation that was recycling batteries, and they left behind something like 6,000 tons of lead, cadmium, and arsenic waste on the Mexican side. Now, why should we care? The things that were left behind in this location were blowing in the wind into a very large community. Not only that, but all of that waste was making it into a tributary of the Tijuana River, which then ends up on the U.S. side. So these are problems that not only affect, obviously, the Mexican side and become very important public health issues, but can potentially also affect the U.S. side. The next slide, slide number 18, this is just kind of to show you what it looks like in the canyon. On the left-hand side, you see a maquiladora where the people in the canyon, a lot of people in the canyon work. They make about $50 a week. On the right-hand side, you see some of the living conditions in the canyon. You see the tires that people are using to try to stabilize the soil. You might be able to see some areas where sewage has flown, so kids walk through it when they play, when they go to school. People have to work, walk through this when they go to work, etc. The next slide is slide number 19. Keith was mentioning that we are using very sophisticated molecular tools that we have available through our Superfund research program. We are developing new tools, including humanized mouse models. And we are in partnership with other Superfund programs so that we can extend that toolbox that we can then use to detect toxicants in the environment and to assess human exposures and risk. The next slide is slide number 20. This shows part of course, we've already explained part of our motivation for doing this, but we also have some evidence that shows that this problem should be looked at closely. On the right-hand corner, you have some of the results from the molecular assays that we've used in this area. And in this area, we found a toxicity equivalence of TCDD about maybe between 2 and 3 orders of magnitude higher than what ATSDR suggests should be reason for investigation. So we have cellular assays that are indicating to us that there is significant toxicity associated with the sediment and the soil found in the canyon, and that could be due to things like polyaromatic hydrocarbons, polychlorinated biphenyls, dioxins and furans, which are some of the compounds that these assays respond to. The next slide is slide 21. Just to give you an example of some of the contamination levels that we're looking at in this area. So the results that say metales y derivados site, that's the abandoned maquiladora site, that's a really well-known, very highly polluted site where we saw upwards of 27 grams of pure lead per kilogram of soil. And then the other one shows the schoolyard, the playground at the schoolyard in the Laureles Canyon. And some of these levels might not stick out just by looking at them. They're not really that much different than some of the levels that you would find in San Diego. What's important here is that because of the erosion, we think that ingestion might be a significant route of exposure. And it's not... It's not too much to think that someone, a child, for example, might be ingesting 2 or 3 grams of this sediment and soil per day. And at that point, these low numbers become significant because that level of ingestion is much higher than what you would expect in a place like San Diego, for example. So the exposure scenarios could be really different. The next slide shows some of the approach that we're taking. We're looking at sites on both the U.S.-Mexico, on both the U.S. side and Mexican side. We're taking a stratified random approach. We're taking cores for soil and sediment to a depth of about 6 inches. We think that there is significant disturbance to the soil and that would both people build new buildings or when the water flushes through the canyon, that a significant depth of the soil and the sediment is disturbed, and that 6-inch coring depth is reflective of that. We are monitoring for heavy metals, for organics, the ones that I've mentioned before, for a suite of heavy metals, using both conventional methods and the molecular bioassays that I mentioned before. The next slide. Ultimately, what we're trying to understand is, this is a slide that shows the land use in the city of Tijuana. We're trying to understand how both natural and anthropogenic factors influence the distribution of toxicants in the environment, in this border environment, and trying to understand also what the risks, both from an ecological perspective and human perspective, are. The next slide is slide number 24. Just to go through quickly, what's really exciting about this effort in the Laureles Canyon is that we're part of a larger team, that is looking at green construction, alternative reuses. The image here on the upper left shows some cargo containers that are being reused to build a building in this case, and there's some ideas of how to use those in the canyon, because a lot of the constructions in the canyon are really precarious. They're made out of garage doors, pieces of cardboard, and other things. There's a colleague of ours shown on the right-hand side, lower right-hand side there, with one of the residents holding one of the pervious pavers. We talked about maybe exploring not only using the pervious pavers, but using different materials that might be able to absorb and sequester different contaminants. There's a lot of activity, participation by the community itself. It's really amazing to see how these people, no matter how poor people are, they care about their health and they care about their family's health. And that motivates them to spend their day off during the week doing things to improve the area, including picking up trash and working on different projects. This shows one of our postdoctoral students. And I'm sorry, slide number 25, please. This at the upper right-hand corner, we are meeting with the city of Tijuana. We're working very closely with the city of Tijuana. They've been very helpful. They're providing us with GIS layers, all kinds of information, and we're really happy to collaborate with them. On the lower left-hand corner, we had meetings with EPA. I think this is what's really exciting for us, is to be able to work closely with people like Mike Gill and other of these colleagues in the EPA office, work with people at ATSDR, work with the community involvement coordinator in Region 9 to really inform our decisions and inform our research and enrich our research through the resources that they have available. This also shows a student, that a graduate student that recently graduated, working in the lab, and some of the work that we're doing to put this into a documentary that then we can then use as a science communication tool. And if I can finish with slide number 26, I'd like to acknowledge again Mike Gill. I was recently at Region 9 giving a presentation. I intend to return. We have some ideas about maybe using this area as a case study and put it in the border indicators report, and looking at some of the problems and the issues that the border indicators report that EPA puts out every year in more detail, using this canyon as a proxy or as a microcosm for U.S.-Mexico border. Beth Anderson and Justin, Marina Vakey, and everybody that helps us do this work at NIEHS, we'd like to thank them. Monica, for all your support and your great ideas. Thank you for letting us participate into this. As part of this program, Oscar Romo, City of Tijuana, Shannon Bradley, Ilya Zaplatsky, Alejandro Hinojosa, Meritzel, and of course the people at the Laureles Canyon, which are now organized into a watershed council and have allowed us to participate in that. We're really excited about this project and the possibilities for not only identifying the problem, but finding solutions that reduce exposure of both ecological receptors and humans. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Iram and Keith. We would like to get to the question and answer session, but I wanted to say a few things first. I just wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the survey and online feedback form. On the links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic, and this page will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. This presentation will also be archived with the soundtrack, so in the near future you can access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is the online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation, slide number 27. Also on the last slide, as was mentioned previously, is a survey developed by the the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program titled Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institutions and Remediation Stakeholders. Please take a moment and fill out that survey. Okay, we can now go ahead and get started with the question and answer session. If you're a phone line participant with a question, go ahead and take your phone off mute by pressing star 6. You can state your name and organization and ask your question. Okay, either everyone's shy or they can't figure out how to get their phones off mute. I just had a couple questions. A lot of the things you're talking about here had to deal with surface water more. I was just wondering, in your monitoring, if you also monitor or plan to monitor groundwater, if you do, if groundwater contaminants are significant, and if groundwater is actually even a significant source of drinking water for the area.
In this particular area, we focus mostly, this is Hiram Saravia, mostly on the soil and sediment just because we think that some of the organic chemicals that we're interested in are bound to the soil and sediment and also the metals. There are not really any significant sources of groundwater in this particular area, but certainly we could test some of the drinking water from the community. Now, and it's hard to tell. It seems that it, from what I've heard, is that those that can afford buy bottled water, which allegedly is of good drinking quality, but those that are very poor can get their drinking water from some of these trucks that bring water into the canyon. And like I said before, most of our effort now is focused on the soil and the sediment, but we're looking for outside resources to really expand some of this monitoring and cover other areas, potentially including the drinking water of the community.
Well, thank you for that. Good answer. Are there any questions from the phone line participants?
Hiram, this is Mike Gill. How are you doing?
Good, Mike. Thank you.
I just want to thank you for this talk and also for your visit up here a couple of months ago to do a similar talk for the folks up here in Region 9, San Francisco. And a lot of the problems that you're outlining would seem to be intractable with the fact that the growth is kind of unchecked and the industries are growing, et cetera, et cetera. So I wondered if you could just chat a bit about any U.S. EPA and Mexican EPA efforts that might go towards stopping this, because prevention is really kind of the key to to answering the problems too. Do you know of any border agreements that you could chat about that might lead to eliminating the problem eventually?
That's actually an interesting question, and we're interested in investigating the potential of forming a sort of a Tijuana River watershed research collaborative that spans the border and that tries to inventory some of these problems in a systematic way and tries to prioritize these problems in terms of their impact on both ecological receptors and human health. There are already, for a number of years now, the Border 2012 program that EPA runs along with the Mexican EPA, or I should say SEMARNAT, the Mexican Secretariat for Natural Resources, has been putting together meetings that have started to get at those questions, and they've done a fair amount of work for the Tijuana River watershed. I should say that the regional universities have been very involved in putting together an atlas for the Tijuana River watershed with some information on some of these issues. But we think that if we could use some of those meetings as a forum to try and connect to the people that are working on these issues on both sides of the border, that we could get together, we could really come up with a good inventory of what the the priority issues are. And it's not just with the intent to come up with an inventory and a list, but to actually come up with applied research that then informs policy decisions. I think that the EPA Border 2012 program has created wonderful collaborations that can really facilitate communicating the research findings to the people that are making the decisions. And there's some funding there, unfortunately, has dwindled over the years, but I think that the value of some of the EPA Border 2012 program is in that it connects people with common interests. And again, we're interested in doing applied research that informs policy that leads to reductions on the ground of exposures.
Now, I just want to chime in too here, Mike. You really bring up a great point, and it's true in the sense that this canyon should not be developed. I mean, the nature of the subsoil there is so unstable that erosion is such a horrific problem. Dust is a gigantic problem. The dust carries all sorts of disease vectors, including pathogens. There's concern about a certain kind of fungus there that causes valley fever. This area should not be developed, and yet it is developing. And this is not unusual. I mean, even in our own country, in San Diego, where we're developing in the floodplains, and you see us developing in fire danger zones. So you look at this, and you see this trajectory, and you say, oh, my God, well, what can we do? And certainly federal to federal, you know, EPA to SEMARNAT kind of agreements is important to help set the stage for this. But I think ultimately solutions for this kind of thing and to get proactive here are going to be coming from the local level, and education is an important part of this. So, for instance, in the canyon, when storm events occur and people are getting washed away and people are dying in flash floods and what have you, those people suffer tremendously, but there's this short institutional memory there, and people rebuild. So you do find some enterprising, engaged scholars like Oscar Romo proposing to do conservation easements and things like that to more proactively deal with guiding the direction of development, to at least make it a little bit less dangerous. But he's got to, you know, work mightily hard to mobilize the support of the community, to get a friendly ear inside the local municipal planning agency, MPLAN, and work with the community. And I think, you know, I think research universities have a role to play in that as well, which is why I'm so pleased with the latitude we've been given by the NIEHS to promote science communication and to get into the community and work with these folks to be able to draw attention to these risk profiles and to begin mobilizing little candles lit in the darkness with pervious pavers at least as somewhat of an ameliorative practice there. So it's, you know, it's daunting. I heard what you said, and I understand what you say, and we have to find those little seeds of alternatives that can be nurtured somehow, and it's going to take a village to make that happen.
We have a question here at the University of Arizona, Justin.
Hi, this is Jay Gandolfi, head of the Superfund program here, and I want to compliment Hiram and Keith for a nice presentation. I have two questions, Keith has kind of went over one of them a little, but there was the dust. What's the direction of dust? Where's the dust flow in this area? Because it's not always raining in this area. I'm sure there's a substantial amount of dryness and dust movement. And then second question is there a snapshot that you guys have of the epidemiology of, you know, what's the health profile of the people that are in this canyon?
Yes, if I could, as you see, I'm sorry, I'm going to thank you, Dr. Gandolfi. The direction of dust, I honestly don't know the answer to that. I know that we have onshore winds that blow from the ocean towards the shore during most of the day, and then the winds revert. And this is a canyon that's not really facing the ocean, so it seems to me that most of the dust would be blown out of the canyon and towards the U.S. But in any event, the amount of dust that's in the air is really tremendous, And it goes back to the issue that I was mentioning before, that even though levels might be seemingly low on the ground of some of these metals and other contaminants, just because of the erosion conditions, the ingestion rates can be really high. Now, in terms of the health...
Before you jump to that, can I just say, Jay, I just recently read, and I don't have the citation in front of me, but there was a study done in Mexico in the border region looking at dust, and it was part of a cost-benefit analysis to paving roads, and there was some calibration of how much dust gets thrown up in a road that hasn't been paved properly compared to roads that were paved properly, and health outcomes associated with exacerbation of asthma and things like this. I could try to dig that up and find that for you if you're interested. Yeah.
Yeah, please. Thank you.
Yes, and then to address the other part of the question about the health outcomes, that's actually really interesting, an important question here, and one that we believe that there's actually a lot of data that needs to be collected with regards to that. There hasn't been an epidemiologic study conducted there, and my sense is that there is some health data being collected at least one or two locations at health community centers within the canyon, but that data is nobody has really looked at that issue. We're at the stage where we're doing as best as we can a site characterization so that then we can begin to get a sense of what the levels of risks are. But of course, a next step would be to connect this to an epidemiologic study and then potentially do some biomonitoring if possible with that also.
Yeah, and if I there's one other study that I ran across, and it might be in environmental health perspective, in which they did do an epidemiological study looking at the advantages of covering dirt floors inside homes with concrete. And it was a four-year program in which they did control groups, and some places they, with a $160 investment of a few bags of cement, some technical support, homes covered the floor of their little shack with concrete, and the other homes didn't. And over a four-year period, they found that the incidence of gastrointestinal disease and asthma and these kinds of things were significantly higher in the homes that did not have the benefit of the covering with concrete. Some of those results were a little bit disputed, and there's some kind of controversy surrounding the sampling methodology and so forth. But in principle, I think it makes sense. And I think it might be in the EHP. I'm making a note here, Jay. I will send you and anybody else that wants those references, those details.
Thank you.
And this is Iram Sarai. I just wanted to add also that there is, again, because nobody, I don't know to what extent people have actually looked at the outcome data, but there's anecdotal evidence, as you would expect, of high rates of hepatitis A. Pathogens are a big, big concern and priority in this canyon area. And there's even less information on toxicants. And what's interesting, too, is that some of the symptoms that might be associated with exposure to some of the toxicants might in some ways be similar to the symptoms associated with exposure to some of the pathogens. And so the doctors dealing with these issues might, I don't know that really anyone has really tried to connect the toxicants with the health outcomes or even the pathogens for that matter. But it's definitely a next step following something like our study.
This is Denise Moreno from the University of Arizona.
Hi, Denise.
Yeah, I have a quick question. It's interesting work that you're doing on the subwatershed of Los Laureles, and from what I understand, you're working in colonias. And so how did you guys become involved, or who are you working with at the community level in order to identify the issues? And then my second question is, who are you collaborating with in order to do the community outreach that you're doing in Mexico?
Yeah, I had, before coming to work with UCSD, I had been part of an NGO that's part of the Waterkeeper Alliance. And back in 2000, we did a community work to try and educate people about the relationship between their health and the environment. At that time, we were able to actually collect, I did some work on pathogens and collected information on some of the contaminants, toxicants as well. And so based on that previous work and what we've heard back then and what we've continued to learn from our colleagues that have continued to work there, we've built this project.
Well, the other entree into this, Denise's colleague, Oscar Romo, who plays a big role in this 30-minute UCSD TV documentary about the case. And to be quite frank with you, one of the reasons we settled on this area is that Oscar, who teaches as a guest lecturer for our Urban Studies and Planning program at UCSD, has been amazingly effective at organizing community in Los Laureles Canyon. And he's built quite a network of supporters organically throughout. I mean, community leaders, the guy that owns the construction, little cottage industry there, women, the principal of the local elementary school, but also the mayor, support from the mayor, even the governor, I mean, has come to the scene partly because of the energy and attention we've been bringing to the place and Oscar's work there to begin investing in sewer and infrastructure. So we've taken advantage of Oscar's connections and networks to make that happen.
Yeah. And if I can add one other thing, too. One of the really exciting developments, and this just happened this year, there is a new watershed council in the Laureles Canyon that is made up of the residents of different parts of the canyon and their community leaders, mostly government agencies, academia, and NGOs, and we're part of that. Has started meeting to, again, to try and identify some of the priority issues, not just with water and the environment, but also it's a really interesting effort to improve governance in this area. It is a watershed council, but they look at anything ranging from job creation to social issues to environment issues to health issues. So this just started meeting, and so we'll be feeding off of that effort to inform our work as well. And it's as close as you can get to the community. And I think both Keith and I, before working on this project, had already been to that location, like I mentioned, and had some relationships developed with some of the local leaders in that location.
And just a footnote, Denise, I know because you speak from experience, and you and Jay and Monica and your colleagues have a wonderful health promotores program that's, you know, I think light years above what just about anybody else is doing in that regard. That the community linkage challenge in all this is crucial. And it's not to be romanticized either, and I will tell you that it's been tough, and there have been, you know, infighting and shifting in leadership roles among the community that have affected the way in which the project unfolds. So it's a tough part of this, and I think you raised a really good question.
This is Justin Crane again. We have a question from one of our simulcast participants. The question is, can you discuss the cost benefits and reliability of using bioassays for organics analysis in surface soils, such as dioxins, furans, PAHs, etc., versus traditional EPA methods and their field use?
This is Hiram Saravia, and there is a study that was done one of the tools that we're using, which is the P450 Human Reporter Gene System, or EPA Method 4425, where they found that this is a, first of all, an accurate, reliable, relatively fast system that reduces cost to about one-fifth of what they would be with conventional methods. And this assay in particular can be used as a screening tool. In other words, you know that a site is contaminated. If you know that a site is contaminated with dioxins, or in fact, even if you don't know, you can use this assay to try and define the limits of the contaminated area. And by doing that, you are reducing your cost by something in the order of a fifth of what they would be if you were just using traditional methods. And I think that that is the working assumption of an effort that we're part of called the Bioassay Network, where not only are we looking at tools like P450 and some novel bioassays, but we think that these assays can be faster, reliable, and better with mixtures also, and cheaper to use than conventional methods. Now, I think what's important to point out here is that we don't mean for conventional methods to be replaced with these assays, because these assays give you a different set of information, but that using these assays in conjunction with conventional methods, that you can have both savings and have information that can potentially be more, can give you information on biologically significant endpoints to better protect both the environment and human health.
Thank you for answering that question. I have another question. As serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in Bolivia in the same types of communities, you know, I see a lot of the same type of things, and you see it all over on TV and in many of areas of the developing world. So you have developed these tools, and you have this toolbox. Is this toolbox available for others who might be, you know, facing these same types of issues?
Well, that's a really great question, and the short answer is not yet. I mean, to be honest with you, it's taking us years to get our own act together in deploying this. I mean, there are obstacles every turn of the way. Just getting, for instance, samples from Mexico to the U.S., the permit took 1 year to get the permit. Finally, we got it, though. So it's going to take a while, and I think as we gradually work out how to deploy these tools and get the collaborators on board, we are hoping that there will be a model that we can deploy and make this easier to do. And the other thing, too, I think is going to be a big help, and we haven't really focused a lot of time on this, is the Bioassay Network, because there's a great partnership there with the EPA and other agencies, ATSDR, for instance, that are going to be instrumental in thinking through how to deploy these advantageous technologies in the context of risk assessment, site characterization, but doing so, not so much from the perspective of the research university having manna from heaven or all the answers and here it is, why aren't you using it, but from a very real institutional perspective of developing the credibility of these tools, working in the context of developing new EPA methods and protocols. That's all hard work, and it takes years. There's no easy solutions, but yeah, we have to do it. And one of the things that we're trying to do is part of our work is focus on solutions and draw a systematic attention to case studies and instances in which the partnerships are working, and then we're making progress. That's the best we can do.
Okay, thank you for that answer. We have another question for one of the simulcast participants. This is from Therese Carpenter of MacTech Engineering and Consulting Incorporated in Phoenix, Arizona. The question is, with respect to handling issues of wastewater and sanitation, has the International Boundary of Water Commission been engaged in any way to try to help address issues plaguing the canyon?
This is Iram Saravia, and my knowledge of how that particular government agency has been involved is frankly limited, but I know that they participate in the Border 2012. EPA organizes Border 2012 meetings every couple of months. There is representatives from both Mexico and U.S. government that facilitate those meetings, and I know that the International Water Boundaries Commission is involved in that. I wish I could answer that question better. I know that they participate in the discussion and they're working on the issue, but I really honestly do not know to what extent they're involved, particularly with the canyon. Now, the canyon is important, again, because even though this is a relatively small area, about 4.5 square miles, there are 80,000 people living there. And not only that, but about between 60 and 80,000, but upwards of 65%, in other words, over half of the city of Tijuana, it looks like the Laureles Canyon. So this is a good model place for trying to solve the problems of the larger watershed. But again, you know, I know that the International Water Boundaries Commission participates in these meetings. I don't know to what extent they are involved specifically in the canyon.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind the presenters that any information that you're going to be providing, such as the dust studies that Keith mentioned, if you can send those to me as well, I can post those on the website for this this presentation, and all the participants will be able to have access to those.
Okay, very good.
We can go back to the phone lines. Are there any more questions from phone line participants?
Yes, I have a question. Am I on the phone?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, this is Mario Castaneda from Gateway Community College, and we are going through the phone line. I have a similar question regarding the wastewater, but this is more related to the groundwater issues. In my experience, sharing information or getting the type of information from both sides, it's been an issue before, way back. Now, the question is, have you identified any potential sources for groundwater contamination? And is the IBWC SILA process been involved in that? And if so, were you able to set up some kind of monitoring schemes or programs to assess that, if there are any potential groundwater contamination?
Good answer, Avia. Let me try to see if I can answer that question. In the city of Tijuana, in the urban area, there are many well-documented cases of groundwater contamination. For the most part, a lot of those wells have been closed. Now, people think that some of the people that are selling water out of their trucks might actually be extracting that water and selling it in the community. There's some anecdotal evidence of that. Outside of the city of Tijuana, there are still substantial more towards the rural areas, resources of groundwater, and those have a variety of sources of contamination, including underwater, like the same similar to what we have here in the U.S., underwater storage tanks that might be leaking, industrial chemicals. In some cases, the concerns come from agricultural activities.
Yes, but I guess I'm trying to see if I know that the USGS has this grant to address some of the groundwater monitoring lack of data, if I can say that. Have you approached them to see if that area can be considered part of their study?
We have not, and I should also say that, to my knowledge, the groundwater resources in the Laureles Canyon, I would expect them to be fairly limited. Although I have to be honestly say also that that's something that we could research further.
I can say if you're interested, there is a contact that we have at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. His name is Graham Kent, and he's Mr. Groundwater Flows. He's kind of a geologist but also quite expert in visualizing and data, and they've got some pretty amazing data sets, I know, around Lake Tahoe, for instance, of groundwater and other areas. And it's possible that if you wanted to go down this road and explore visualization of groundwater sources in the border region, that he'd be somebody that you would want to talk with on how to go about doing that. That's Graham Kent at SIO.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I just want to add that to the group because the USGS might have some additional funding because of what they do and this transboundary process that they have.
That's interesting.
You know, that's a very interesting question. Again, honestly, I don't know that there are any active wells in this area. my assumption, because it's such a small, limited area, has always been that most of the drinking water is either brought at the store, bottled water, or is trucked in, and then the water that's trucked in could be coming from contaminated wells. But that's actually certainly a very good point and something that, we'll look at, further into.
Okay, thank you. I will mute my phone back again.
Do we have any more questions from the phone line participants? Okay, if there are no more questions at this time, just let me remind everyone that you can go to the Clue In seminar homepage where you can find Keith Pizzoli and Haram Sarabia's contact information, and you are welcome to contact them via email with additional questions. I would like to thank Monica Ramirez and the University of Arizona for organizing this presentation, and of course our presenters, Keith Pizzoli and Hiram Sarabia with University of California, San Diego. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you everyone for your participation.